listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 48, part 2, where we continue to discuss Jakes and Stamp's 1995 text, Level and Type of Capability in Relation to Executive Organization. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We are continuing to discuss Jakes and Stamp's Level and Type of Capability in Relation to Executive Organization, or Stratified Systems Theory. And in this part of the podcast, we're going to delve a little bit more into the second part of their paper, which discusses examples of how the system can be used and ideas for leadership's role in developing personnel.
Or put another way, how it was attempted to be used at the time. And we probably have some interesting reactions about, was this really the right way to go? But let me just start with a kind of a summary of one particularly interesting section, which I think is one that it touches on a theme that is in a lot of the SST readings oriented on military organizations. And this comes into that leader development. Okay, so what do you do with this theory? And in their part two, on pages basically from 33 to 37, is when they talk about assessing personnel. So we've got the strata, and we've theoretically designed the organization. We said that, okay, positions at certain levels of organization, if that's the way that we go, positions at certain levels of organization would be an optimal fit for folks who can satisfy the requirements of a particular strata. And so then how do you go about assessing and then follow on with the developing and the slating or the assignments of officer personnel in order to make sure that we're getting optimum performance from everybody based on where we can, you know, based on their capacities versus what the organization needs. And so the questions that they bring up, kind of read them. So the term requirements can be interpreted in a number of entirely different ways by the raters, as, for example, raters being the supervisor who writes the report card for officers, for an officer's performance. So you have a rater, and the senior rater is the one who is above the rater. Did the officer achieve his target output? Did the officer give the required quality of performance, even though he rarely achieved targeted output because of difficult circumstances? And did the officer's unit sustain its required output despite the officer? So I found those three questions fascinating because the section and everything about it is about potential, but the questions themselves are very much performance oriented. And so you take the answers to those questions, and the page 34, they basically give you all of the challenges. Performance appraisal is bedeviled by the fact that the terms apply to at least six significantly different conditions: output, success, productivity, and various others. And so then by the time that you get to the assessment of actual potential, what you basically have is, if the officer being assessed had the necessary training and experience, at what grade do you judge he would be capable of working at the present time? Or if the officer being assessed were to have the necessary training and experience, do you judge he would ever be capable of promotion to a grade higher than you stated in reply to the previous question? So all of the responsibility, of course, and this was the culture at the time, all of the responsibility is placed on the rater or the one above the rater, the senior rater, to basically judge what strata does this officer fit, or what does the performance indicate? There's some interesting, you know, implications for that, because in a lot of ways, there's so much in terms of what officers do, and I'm sure that this applies more widely, that is simply not observed or not observable. So then you really have a challenge of trying to make sure that you understand everything about what the officer is capable of, you know, from a cognitive standpoint, based on just observances of a subset of the officer's behavior.
Well, not only that, Tom, but the fact that you don't always get to assign work to meet or exceed his current level of capability and use it as a development potential. And therefore, a lot of times you're making this assessment based on what he does that's part of his normal job, because you don't always get these special projects that you can assign to everyone. And then you have to use that and then interpret based on seen and unseen things that you were talking about, which was a great point, about his potential for other kinds of work. And I think they understate the incredible complexity and difficulty of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the assumption, I think, was that with this being written with the context of the traditional military organizational hierarchies and possibly in a context where you have a large military base, where you may very well have all of these hierarchical levels physically present on the same base. So like if you take a Fort Bragg where the Corps and most of its subordinate units were physically there at Bragg, there was greater chance of observation of somebody two levels below you to at least be able to approximate, you know, answering these kinds of questions. And even in those particular circumstances, the level of detail necessary to answer the questions as they pose it here, you know, it's difficult. The pace of an organization's activity probably precluded that level of observation then, and it certainly as I advanced it and the pace only got faster. it's hard to imagine that kind of measure being useful now.
I completely agree, because I used to note when I would go in for performance evaluations or mentoring or counseling sessions, just what Tom said, that my supervisor probably saw a tenth, if that much, or the rater saw a tenth of what I was doing compared to the person who was directly supervising my work but wasn't actually the rater. And I don't know how much those two were communicating, but I always thought that was daunting, particularly when there's a custom in several branches of the military, including the one I was in, of requiring the officer to write his own evaluation. And then with some minor editing by the rater. So that was a very confusing experience.
Yeah, and I had similar experiences in the latter part of my career as well, where in a lot of ways my performance was I basically wrote some of my own performance ratings. Now that's something that the military, at present day, is really, really trying to address. But it is hard, because the fundamental question of how much time does it take to provide a adequate performance and be able to document it in a manner in which you come up with something that can be fairly comparable across, basically tens of thousands of peers. If you're talking about the middle ranks of the organization, how do you systematize that? And so you can kind of see that, you know, this is, we are being critical, but that's actually the same problem that they were trying to address back in 1991 when this report was written, was not just be able to assess performance and potential in an individual, but try to figure out how do you systematize it? How do you come up with a common set of questions that everybody from within the United States to far-flung posts around the world, different contexts, what is at least a common set of questions that you can ask that you hope would get a calibrated response, so that at some point, if we're going to make decisions about who's going to fit in which strata, we're not doing things like inflating. Like my unit, all of my officers are tremendous. They're all strata six. You see what I mean?
Well, you know what's the challenge with asking people questions without observing what they actually do in reality.
It's almost like, where do you begin?
There is always a gap.
Yeah.
Right? Because this seems to be one of the symptoms of the how stratified systems theory also deals with information, and that the emphasis on information processing as opposed to information seeking, and specifically information seeking that has to do with behavior, is really misplaced. At least if we are to look at this as a practically applicable kind of a model, because the way the system regurgitates information is very much discouraging what we would probably call innovation. And we talked about this in a couple of Carnegie Mellon episodes as well in the past, and that specifically that the way stratified systems theory goes about identification of new information is handicapped towards not doing that, basically. So because it's based on schemas, right? And schemas determine stratas, and stratas are what kind of drives the whole show. The degree to which new information deviates from stratas is kind of directly proportionate to how much that information will be ignored in many ways. That's why there's an emphasis on traits rather than behaviors and that kind of stuff.
So we surveyed some of the weakness regarding the performance appraisal. And as Ralph and Tom were saying, you know, these things are still questions we're asking now. And those that were designed back in the day, we can understand why there was some appeal to that idea, as Tom was saying, of having something that was systematic that could be applied all across a large organization. So one thing that we said in the previous part was that the theory is very interesting, and it seems to have almost in some points not necessarily conflicting but multifaceted aspects that can help us think about it itself in different ways. So if we were to think about the problem of performance appraisal using some of the elements of SST, what would be the ways to think about differently, you know, different to what is written and what we discuss? What are the possible opportunities that lay in using this theory to rethink this this issue?
Well, I think the main one is that that organizations are not monolithic in the sense that you can't appraise all personnel against the same kind of a benchmark of where they are in the organization, because different stratas will kind of have different requirements and different performance metrics, that sort of stuff. So the thing that Ralph alluded to, the up or out principle, where you, if you don't get promoted after a while, you are invited to leave. I love that expression. It's terrifying.
Sorry, that's the nicest way to say it.
Yeah, not if you're on the receiving end. I think that that's one of the things that this really brings to the table, that you evaluate individuals individually with respect to what they do rather than with respect to where they ought to be in the hierarchy or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we agree that the questions put are necessarily the best, but this is a very strong and timely and almost contemporary kind of idea.
Another aspect of how this is applied and the challenges in military or other organizations is, what, as Dimitri said, this upper-out concept or philosophy, it's fundamental to the entire officer management system in the U.S. military. And that also means that you are almost always assigned your stratum level, not based on your capability per se, but just based on your what we call time in service. And so at 10 years time in service, you could assign this kind of position, whether it's at the Army, Brigade, Headquarters level, or some such thing in the Navy. And you may or may not be ready for that or capable or have the levels of abstraction. But that doesn't matter, because the nature of the officer system is that at 10 years, it's your time. And then Dimitri said another thing I thought was really interesting, and he was talking about the types of positions that people can occupy and where they might be in a say real versus monolithic organization. And that's actually one of the things we struggle with in the military, is that people, you can't just assume that they have the same developmental background. In many organizations, yep, that's true, and there's a series of positions they go through, but we're often cautioned in the promotion boards that some people don't have traditional backgrounds, and therefore, if you assess them the same way you would using your template or model or schema, as Demetrius was saying, you're going to automatically penalize them because, or maybe unconsciously penalize them. And this is a problem for women and people of color sometimes in the military, just because of the nature of the jobs they choose and what they find interesting in it, that they'll have what we sometimes call non-traditional backgrounds. And you actually have to make that a precept of the promotion situation to get people to consciously overcome that and say, you must rise above that. Otherwise, you're going to penalize a woman who at a certain time in her career wasn't allowed to have this kind of position or was given a special assignment because she was having children, which the military wants to be friendly towards. And yet you can have these unconscious biases that get in the way of not only diversity. I mean, that's not an insignificant issue, but promoting the best people. I mean, you could have somebody who's just a fabulous leader, but they've had these other experiences or some alternate career paths, and you'd just be ignoring them. And that's definitely not good for selecting the right talent for these kinds of senior positions.
And that's particularly the case when we talk about certain functional areas, which, think about something like cyber. Just about all organizations nowadays are wrestling with cyber issues, whether it's needing to protect their systems, or in the case of nations, what they do to protect their own infrastructure, hacking and all that stuff. So, you have absolutely right that the organization, we can't look at the organization monolithically. So what we would need is, if we're going to attempt to stratify levels of capability and capacity of individuals, it's got to be flexible. It cannot be one type of a metaphor, a single metaphor fitting all possible situations, because a traditional combat force behaves differently than a cyber force, for example. There are different makeups, they're different, all kinds of stuff. So you've got to have ways of offering different methods of stratifying. And the Army did this at one time because they found this problem. What they did was, originally you had one category of which all officers were essentially compared against each other. It was called a competitive category. And they found that, that worked well with the combat folks, but didn't work so well for folks who were doing weapon systems acquisitions, some of the support folks. So then they broke it up into four pyramids. Okay, so if you're in particular branches or subcomponents, then you're going to be compared against just these these branches. And if you're in these other branches, you'll be compared together. So then you sort of differentiate according to your career field. But then that only goes so far. No matter how you divide it, what Ralph was talking about with folks who just simply don't, their career patterns just simply don't fit anything. And you'll still always have a bit of a, and I'm one of those cases, because I spent an inordinate amount of time working as a personal staff officer at very, very high levels of an organization. There was no career field for me in those roles. So I could never be compared on equal footing with other officers, which was fine. I was happy, but it's like you can try to make a system fit, but it just, there will always be some percentage of the organization where it just can't fit. It would seem to me.
A couple of things on that. I think, I don't know if you already mentioned before, but a lot of these theories set up to understand a closed organization. And the question of non-traditional backgrounds, I mean, we are talking about it, still thinking about a single organization, but there is also the issue of people living and coming and so on and so forth. All the movement exists around organizations, which bring, complicates a bit of this story. But I wanted to go back a bit. So one thing that Tom, you're saying, it seems that bring an interesting aspect that is not considered as well, is the question of expertise. So there is almost seems to be this trade-off in which in trying to create a very standardized formal system for performance review, we end up losing what's very central to the work and to the assessment of the work, one could argue, is exactly the question of expertise. But I wanted to invite us to think of a different issue that I think is also very interesting in the discussion on the text about performance appraisal and so on and so forth, which is the division that is suggested between the review and the way it's set up for standard performance appraisal and the one geared towards promotion and how there seems to be a separation on between these two. So I was wondering what we think about that.
Well, I can give you one perspective. I think when the authors are talking in section two about how it it's actually the end of section one and then rolls into section two, they're talking about ideal state, how it should work, that you should have these things separated, and they give really good reasons for why, which I thought were persuasive. The trouble though is that the authors don't seem to recognize or don't seem to acknowledge that, as Tom said earlier, people are really, really busy in all sorts of forms of work, particularly at the senior levels. And I think there's this misconception, because I was at the higher strata levels, maybe not 25 years, but pretty high levels. They have this misconception that you have all this discretion about what you're going to do and far more opportunities to design your own work. And that's only true in some small areas, that a lot of what gets given to you as a senior leader is non-discretionary based on the role you play in the organization and the functions you have. And so when you look at this, I think a nice description of the optimal or ideal way of separating performance counseling from promotion or developmental assessments, I wonder how practical that is, because the amount of time it takes to do that, both Tom and I talked about that, is amazing. It's an amazing amount of time. And I actually did try to do that to the extent I could. I basically would do counseling sessions where I would write things down and give it to the officer, but I would not make it part of their performance evaluation unless they were not, their performance was not improving. And that's sort of a separate issue. You have mechanisms for that. And I found that though, and I would do those monthly, and I found that was necessary to get the more detailed knowledge of what they were doing and stay in touch with the work they were doing and give them that feedback. And then there are many other officers. The only time you see the senior officer is twice a year to discuss performance, specific performance discussions. It's with these evaluation forms that are used for promotion. And that's it. And these other officers aren't focused that way. And I would sometimes point it out to people and they would say, well, that's the way I was trained, or I don't have time. And so that really just struck me in that ideal description. Yes, it would be nice if the world worked that way, but I didn't, that's not what I really saw in the military. I don't want to say it's impractical. It's just, I think you have to invent different human beings or invent the work differently.
Well, I can add a couple of numbers to that, if that would help. You think about the typical direct supervisor, you know, at the lower levels of the organization. You're generally directly supervising, let's say 3 to 7. Three is typically the kind of the standard, and you have maybe a few more than that. By the time you get up to the upper levels, the number of direct reports and second level reports, such as who a general officer might rate or senior rate, can go well into the hundreds. I think the most I would say was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 150. So a lot of those supervisory relationships are distant. I myself had 4 performance evaluations in my 29-year career in which I never once met or shook hands with or engaged in any way with my senior rater, who was 2 levels above me, because of where I physically was or the circumstances surrounding the unit. So there is a practical aspect, and this is something that is being addressed, because it's really hard. If you want to have a fair system, It's got to have a fighting chance of being practical. And how do you address the fact that some of these leaders have such an incredible horizontal span of control? And this is kind of counterintuitive in a way, because everybody thinks about the military organizations being deeply vertical. But when you get up to the upper levels, it really does have a lot more of a horizontal feel to it. It's a lot flatter, and some of the same span of control issues are present.
So let's think again. You know, I'll re-ask the same question as before. So thinking about the SSST insights and trying to calibrate that to the real world experience and how we know that things get much more messy and there's always time limits and it's never possible to implement things as maybe on paper they would look ideal. What other alternatives or ideas does this approach give us?
So here's one thought on that. I think it's a nice description of the things you have to think about. And I think what you do with the discretion that you have is think about, well, how do I use these in a way that's meaningful? So that question that Tom was reading from earlier, which I thought was absolutely fascinating when you were looking at potential, and this question, it was on page 36, where you're supposed to ask yourself, if you're the rater, if the officer being assessed were to have the necessary training and experience, do you judge that he would be capable, and the rest of that sentence, I'm thinking, wow, that is like mind reading or fortune telling. And yet you do some of that as a senior leader. It's not quite that way. So the way I used it, and I think there's some overlap with stratified systems theory, is I would look at the work that the officer was doing, and I would say, how are they demonstrating their ability to grow? How rapidly are they learning? And are they making the same mistakes over and over again? And I would try to help them with the mistakes they were making. But are they making the same mistakes over and over again? Are they not listening to people? Are they so bullheaded that they're not developing? Even if they're an expert at whatever it is that they're doing, which that's part of that expertise issue that you said was lacking, Pedro. So I would look for that. I would look for how are they learning? And are they, when things go well, are they using that to apply to other jobs? Are they, when things don't go well, are they getting smarter and doing that on the next job? And I think that's kind of a practical way to take the reality of what you see people doing and the necessity. I completely agree that you have to assess people's potential and then saying, what am I seeing in there, without trying to imagine what they would do with different training and those kind of things. Because I think that's impractical. But I do think it's possible to say, how are they learning? How are they dealing with experience? How are they constructing their reality? What do they do with that? And then there's also a little bit about what do other people say it's like to work with them, which you have to be very careful about doing in the military. But I think that's also an important practical aspect of how you use these ideas.
There is an interesting paradox in the stratified systems theory that involves different stratas, people at different strata, communicating and understanding each other, that probably doesn't quite pan out like this in practice, because, you know, we're not in practice operating on strata by strata basis, that there's a constant oscillation and movement. But kind of just reading this as a document, as a theoretical framework that comes forth after a while, and that has to do with that people at different strata, according to their definition of time frames and capabilities and all that kind of stuff, should not be able to relate to one another well. So there is an inbuilt deficiency in knowledge management that comes with the theory here. Did you spot that?
Yes, that's a great observation. And I would say you do see some of that with people who have these different ways of thinking about the nature of the work. Because remember, the strata is a little different from the organizational structure. It's the kinds of ways you deal with reality, construct experience. And absolutely, I saw that. It was difficult to have a conversation with somebody about planning for the future or assessing, you know, models or those kinds of things with somebody who was very concrete, because that just didn't fit in their worldview and how they understood things. And it was rare to encounter somebody like that, but every now and then you would find somebody who the class was so distinct, it was difficult to find common ground, particularly when you there was conflict over something, which happens often enough. So, yes, I saw that completely.
Yeah, and in traditional bureaucracies and traditional organizations, those people are kind of sprinkled around because the division of labor is based on functions. But in this theory, Jax and colleagues, they almost cluster them into particular parts of the organization or levels that kind of assemble these types of people within certain functions at certain levels. And that might, I mean, theoretically, greatly impede any kind of collaboration along knowledge sharing basis, like whatsoever, because levels just don't understand one another. There's a lot of pragmatic and semantic boundaries that are potentially arising from designing an organization along the stratified systems theory view.
Right. So I'll give you a very good example of that, or at least what I consider a good example. So when I was managing and leading and working with nuclear operators, some of the smartest people on the planet in the Navy, they would just get incredibly frustrated and borderline furious with some of the people who have a different strata than they were and assigned into one particular role like personnel. And then because in the nuclear community or propulsion systems area, you have to be used to saying, hey, we can't send everybody home today because we have a certain set of services we must provide. You know, you can't just shut down people's plumbing and water and electricity because you're going to take a holiday or have a special picnic. But they would go to the personnel office and they'd have something they needed for promotion or something that was important. And they would have received no warning of this. And there'd be a sign on the door saying office closed, which means all the functions are closed because we're on a picnic. And they would just go nuts over stuff like that. And in fact, you can understand why people would do a picnic and stuff, but they couldn't understand, well, why is there nobody in the office? And occasionally it was for things, we're not talking about minor things. A person couldn't transfer that day or they couldn't leave because the office just closed and there was no backup. So when I was senior enough, I could call their boss and say, bring somebody back in because my person has to leave today and they've got travel plans. And it's funny. And I'd have to tell them, well, they just don't see the world the way you guys do. And I can't undo the fact that they're on a picnic, but we can take some corrective action. I had many interventions I had to do that way.
So this is very interesting. And I think it leads us to an interesting, very contemporary dimension of the text, which I was thinking while reading that, which is this discussion of time, which is something that has surfaced more strongly in contemporary research in organization management theory. And, you know, Dimitris was citing the issue of boundaries and knowledge boundaries and how work when people from different perspectives and expertise comes together or departments, whatever, there is like this difficulty in working together. But rarely you see people talking about temporal boundaries, or you can even say a clash of different work rhythms or work, I don't know how to say, time horizons, as the example of Ralph was very illustrative. There is some work that has been done, but not about within organization. I mean, in part, yes. So there is this interesting work done by Juliane Reinecke and Chad Zanzari in a paper called When Times Collide, which is about work in international development and how within this specific agency, there was this kind of clash of about different ways of seeing time. One, it was very much about budgeting and planning and very much like normal time and how you can think about development and local ideas from different communities of what does it mean to spend resources on development, how to measure that and how time should be thought in those terms. So it's not the same that we are discussing here, but that's just an example of how this discussion has been reemerged and time has become an interesting insight. And it's interesting to see how it was already been discussing in a rich way by SSS.
Rich way is not how I would call it, because
okay, so it was already hinted.
Yeah,
at,
hinted
sorry,
at is
yes,
a, be- is a better way, because even though time is critical variable in the stratified systems theory, they never actually deal with it. They don't dissect whether it's nonlinear, whether it's multidimensional, whether it's cultural. So, you know, we had an episode on banana time where we were talking about like time as a cultural and experiential product. We had episodes, especially way back, kind of on more scientific management approaches, where time is very much just a production variable, so it's very linear and things. Here, there is so much potential for discussions on temporality, on whether time is a product, an experience, whether it's kind of institutional or cultural construct, but there is no discussion of this. And one would imagine the different strata would come with different temporal sort of paradigms attached to them, but they don't on this paper, on the way how theory is explained, I believe, anywhere. I mean, Tom, I think you read more about SST and the requisite organization than probably all of us, but I don't believe Jax ever goes into discussions of temporalities.
Not really. And I think that brings us to kind of a point as to whether or not time or temporality is the only real way of differentiating the strata. And I think we can probably think about this as we get ready for part three. If not time, or at least if not time as they've defined it, what would we decide would be a better way of differentiating strata? I can think of a couple of things that perhaps we can explore in the next part.
Tune in for the next part of the episode to gain those insights. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and find it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing Jakes and Stamps' 1995 text on stratified systems theory, here on Talking About Organizations.